unless he is a man of some education. The word has, in fact, moved up in the social scale and ceased to be a swear word for the purposes of the working classes. The current London adjective, now tacked on to every noun, is fuck. No doubt, in time, fuck, like bloody, will find its way into the drawing room and be replaced by some other word. The whole business of swearing, especially English swearing, is mysterious. Of its very nature, swearing is as irrational as magic. Indeed, it is a species of magic. But there is also a paradox about it, namely this. Our intention in swearing is to shock and wound, which we do by mentioning something that should be kept secret, usually something to do with the sexual functions. But the strange thing is that when a word is well established as a swear word, it seems to lose its original meaning. That is, it loses the thing that made it into a swear word. A word becomes an oath because it means a certain thing, and because it has become an oath, it ceases to mean that thing. For example, fuck. The Londoners do not now use, or very seldom use, this word in its original meaning. It is on their lips from morning till night, but it is a mere expletive and means nothing. Similarly with bugger, which is rapidly losing its original sense. One can think of similar instances in French. For example, con, which is now a quite meaningless expletive. The rule seems to be that words accepted as swear words have some magical character, which sets them apart and makes them useless for ordinary conversation. Words used as insults seem to be governed by the same paradox as swear words. A word becomes an insult, one would suppose, because it means something bad, but in practice its insult value has little to do with its actual meaning. For example, the most bitter insult one can offer to a Londoner is bastard, which, taken for what it means, is hardly an insult at all. And the worst insult to a woman, either in London or Paris, is cow, a name which might even be a compliment, for cows are among the most likeable of animals. Evidently a word is an insult simply because it is meant as an insult, without reference to its dictionary meaning. Words, especially swear words, being what public opinion chooses to make them. In this connection, it is interesting to see how a swear word can change character by crossing a frontier. In England, you can print "Je m'en fous" without protest from anybody. In France, you have to print it "Je m'en f blank". Or, as another example, take the word barn shoot, a corruption of the Hindustani word bahinshut. A vile and unforgivable insult in India, this word is a piece of gentle badinage in England. I've even seen it in a school textbook. It was in one of Aristophanes' plays, and the annotator suggested it as a rendering of some gibberish spoken by a Persian ambassador. Presumably the annotator knew what bainchut meant, but because it was a foreign word, it had lost its magical swear word quality and could be printed. One other thing is noticeable about swearing in London, and that is that the men do not usually swear in front of the women. In Paris it's quite different. A Parisian workman may prefer to suppress an oath in front of a woman, but he is not at all scrupulous about it, and the women themselves swear freely. The Londoners are more polite, or more squeamish, in this matter. These are a few notes that I have set down more or less at random. It's a pity that someone capable of dealing with the subject does not keep a yearbook of London slang and swearing, registering the changes accurately. It might throw useful light upon the formation, development, and obsolescence of words. Chapter 33. The £2 that B had given me lasted about 10 days. That it lasted so long was due to Paddy, who had learned parsimony on the road and considered even one sound meal a day a wild extravagance. Food, to him, had come to mean simply bread and margarine, the eternal tea and two slices, which will cheat hunger for an hour or two. He taught me how to live, food, bed, tobacco and all, at the rate of half a crown a day, and he managed to earn a few extra shillings by glimming in the evenings. It was a precarious job, because illegal, but it brought in a little and eked out our money. One morning we tried for a job as sandwich men. We went at 5 to an alleyway behind some offices, but there was already a queue of 30 or 40 men waiting, and after 2 hours we were told that there was no work for us. We hadn't missed much, for sandwich men have an unenviable job. They are paid about 3 shillings a day for 10 hours' work. It's hard work, especially in windy weather, and there is no skulking, for an inspector comes round frequently to see that the men are on their beat. To add to their troubles, they are only engaged by the day, or sometimes for 3 days, never weekly, so that they have to wait hours for their job every morning. The number of unemployed men who are ready to do the work makes them powerless to fight for better treatment. The job all sandwich men covet is distributing handbills, which is paid for at the same rate. When you see a man distributing handbills, you can do him a good turn by taking one, for he goes off duty when he has distributed all his bills. Meanwhile, we went on with the lodging-house life, a squalid, eventless life of crushing boredom. For days together there was nothing to do but sit in the underground kitchen, reading yesterday's newspaper, or, when one could get hold of it, a back number of the Union Jack. It rained a great deal at this time, and everyone who came in steamed, so that the kitchen stank horribly. One's only excitement was the periodical tea and two slices. I don't know how many men are living this life in London. It must be thousands, at the least. As to Paddy, it was actually the best life he had known for 2 years past. His interludes from tramping, the times when he had somehow laid hands on a few shillings, had all been like this. The tramping itself had been slightly worse. Listening to his whimpering voice, he was always whimpering when he wasn't eating, one realised what torture unemployment must be to him. People are wrong when they think that an unemployed man only worries about losing his wages. On the contrary, an illiterate man, with the work habit in his bones, needs work even more than he needs money. An educated man can put up with enforced idleness, which is one of the worst evils of poverty, but a man like Paddy, with no means of filling up time, is as miserable out of work as a dog on the chain. That is why it's such nonsense to pretend that those who have come down in the world are to be pitied above all others. The man who really merits pity is the man who has been down from the start and faces poverty with a blank, resourceless mind. It was a dull time, and little of it stays in my mind except for talks with Bozo. Once the lodging house was invaded by a slumming party. Paddy and I had been out, and coming back in the afternoon we heard sounds of music downstairs. We went down to find 3 gentlepeople, sleekly dressed, holding a religious service in our kitchen. They were a grave and reverend senior in a frock coat, a lady sitting at a portable harmonium, and a chinless youth toying with a crucifix. It appeared that they had marched in and started to hold the service without any kind of invitation whatever. It was a pleasure to see how the lodgers met this intrusion. They didn't offer the smallest rudeness to the slummers. They just ignored them. By common consent, everyone in the kitchen, 100 men perhaps, behaved as though the slummers had not existed. There they stood, patiently singing and exhorting, and no more notice was taken of them than if they had been earwigs. The gentleman in the frock coat preached a sermon, but not a word of it was audible. It was drowned in the usual din of songs, oaths, and the clattering of pans. Men sat at their meals and card games, 3 feet away from the harmonium, peaceably ignoring it. Presently the slummers gave it up and cleared out, not insulted in any way, but merely disregarded. No doubt they consoled themselves by thinking how brave they had been, freely venturing into the lowest dens, etc., etc. Bozo said that these people came to the lodging-house several times a month. They had influence with the police, and the deputy could not exclude them. It's curious how people take it for granted that they have a right to preach at you and pray over you as soon as your income falls below a certain level. After 9 days, B's £2 was reduced to 1 and 9 pence. Paddy and I set aside 18 pence for our beds and spent 3 pence on the usual tea and 2 slices, which we shared, an appetizer rather than a meal. By the afternoon we were damnably hungry, and Paddy remembered a church near King's Cross Station where a free tea was given once a week to tramps. This was the day, and we decided to go there. Bozo, though it was rainy weather and he was almost penniless, would not come, saying that churches were not his style. Outside the church quite 100 men were waiting, dirty types who had gathered from far and wide at the news of a free tea, like kites round a dead buffalo. Presently the doors opened, and a clergyman and some girls shepherded us into a gallery at the top of the church. It was an evangelical church, gaunt and wilfully ugly, with texts about blood and fire blazoned on the walls, and a hymn book containing 1,251 hymns. Reading some of the hymns, I concluded that the book would do as it stood for an anthology of bad verse. There was to be a service after the tea, and the regular congregation were sitting in the well of the church below. It was a weekday, and there were only a few dozen of them, mostly stringy old women who reminded one of boiling fowls. We ranged ourselves in the gallery pews and were given our tea. It was a £1 jam jar of tea each, with six slices of bread and margarine. As soon as tea was over, a dozen tramps who had stationed themselves near the door bolted to avoid the service. The rest stayed, less from gratitude than lacking the cheek to go. The organ let out a few preliminary hoots, and the service began. And instantly, as though at a signal, the tramps began to misbehave in the most outrageous way. One wouldn't have thought such scenes possible in a church. All round the gallery, men lolled in their pews, laughed, chattered, leaned over and flicked pellets of bread among the congregation. I had to restrain the man next to me, more or less by force, from lighting a cigarette. The tramps treated the service as a purely comic spectacle. It was, indeed, a sufficiently ludicrous service, the kind where there are sudden yells of hallelujah and endless extempore prayers. But their behaviour passed all bounds. There was one old fellow in the congregation, Brother Bootle, or some such name, who was often called on to lead us in prayer, and whenever he stood up, the tramps would begin stamping as though in a theatre. They said that on a previous occasion he had kept up an extempore prayer for 25 minutes, until the minister had interrupted him. Once, when Brother Bootle stood up, a tramp called out, 2-1, he don't beat 7 minutes, so loud that the whole church must hear. It was not long before we were making far more noise than the minister. Sometimes somebody below would send up an indignant hush, but it made no impression. We had set ourselves to guy the service, and there was no stopping us. It was a queer, rather disgusting scene. Below were the handful of simple, well-meaning people trying hard to worship, and above were the 100 men whom they had fed, deliberately making worship impossible. A ring of dirty, hairy faces grinned down from the gallery, openly jeering. What could a few women and old men do against 100 hostile tramps? They were afraid of us, and we were, frankly, bullying them. It was our revenge upon them for having humiliated us by feeding us. The minister was a brave man. He thundered steadily through a long sermon on Joshua, and managed almost to ignore the sniggers and chattering from above. But in the end, perhaps goaded beyond endurance, he announced loudly, "I shall address the last 5 minutes of my sermon to the unsaved sinners." Having said which, he turned his face to the gallery and kept it so for 5 minutes, lest there should be any doubt about who were saved and who unsaved. But much we cared. Even while the minister was threatening hell fire, we were rolling cigarettes, and at the last amen we clattered down the stairs with a yell, many agreeing to come back for another free tea next week. The scene had interested me. It was so different from the ordinary demeanour of tramps, from the abject, worm-like gratitude with which they normally accept charity. The explanation, of course, was that we outnumbered the congregation, and so were not afraid of them. A man receiving charity practically always hates his benefactor. It is a fixed characteristic of human nature, and when he has 50 or 100 others to back him, he'll show it. In the evening, Paddy unexpectedly earned another 18 pence at Glimming. It was exactly enough for another night's lodging, and we put it aside and went hungry till 9 the next evening. Bozo, who might have given us some food, was away all day. The pavements were wet, and he had gone to the Elephant and Castle, where he knew of a pitch under shelter. Luckily I still had some tobacco, so that the day might have been worse. At 8:30, Paddy took me to the Embankment, where a clergyman was known to distribute meal tickets once a week. Under Charing Cross Bridge 50 men were waiting, mirrored in the shivering puddles. Some of them were truly appalling specimens. They were embankment sleepers, and the embankment dredges up worse types than the spike. One of them, I remember, was dressed in an overcoat without buttons, laced up with rope, a pair of ragged trousers, and boots exposing his toes. Not a rag else. He was bearded like a fakir, and he had managed to streak his chest and shoulders with some horrible black filth resembling train oil. What one could see of his face under the dirt and hair was bleached white as paper by some malignant disease. I heard him speak, and he had a goodish accent, as of a clerk or shopwalker. Presently the clergyman appeared, and the men ranged themselves in a queue in the order in which they had arrived. The clergyman was a nice, chubby, youngish man, and curiously enough very like Charlie, my friend in Paris. He was shy and embarrassed, and didn't speak except for a brief good evening. He simply hurried down the line of men, thrusting a ticket upon each, and not waiting to be thanked. The consequence was that, for once, there was genuine gratitude, and everyone said that the clergyman was a fucking good fella. Someone, in his hearing, I believe, called out, "Well, he'll never be a fucking bishop." This, of course, intended as a warm compliment. The tickets were worth sixpence each, and were directed to an eating-house not far away. When we got there, we found that the proprietor, knowing that the tramps could not go elsewhere, was cheating by only giving 4 pennyworth worth of food for each ticket. Paddy and I pooled our tickets and received food which we could have got for 7 pence or 8 pence at most coffee shops. The clergyman had distributed well over £1 in tickets, so that the proprietor was evidently swindling the tramps to the tune of 7 shillings or more a week. This kind of victimisation is a regular part of a tramp's life, and it will go on as long as people continue to give meal tickets instead of money. Paddy and I went back to the lodging-house, and still hungry, loafed in the kitchen, making the warmth of the fire a substitute for food. At 10:30, Bozo arrived, tired out and haggard, for his mangled leg made walking an agony. He hadn't earned a penny at screeving, all the pitches under shelter being taken, and for several hours he had begged outright, with one eye on the policeman. He had amassed 8 pence, a penny short of his kip. It was long past the hour for paying, and he had only managed to slip indoors when the deputy wasn't looking. At any moment he might be caught and turned out to sleep on the embankment. Bozo took the things out of his pockets and looked them over, debating what to sell. He decided on his razor, took it round the kitchen, and in a few minutes he had sold it for 3 pence, enough to pay his kip, buy a basin of tea, and leave a halfpenny over. Bozo got his basin of tea and sat down by the fire to dry his clothes. As he drank the tea, I saw that he was laughing to himself as though at some good joke. Surprised, I asked him what he had to laugh at. "It's bloody funny," he said. "It's funny enough for Punch. What do you think I've been and done?"
"What?"
"Sold my razor without having a shave first. Of all the fucking fools."
He hadn't eaten since the morning, had walked several miles with a twisted leg, his clothes were drenched, and he had a halfpenny between himself and starvation. With all this, he could laugh over the loss of his razor. One could not help admiring him.
This ends Disc 5, Down and Out in Paris and London, Disc 6.
Chapter 34. The next morning, our money being at an end, Paddy and I set out for the Spike. We went southward by the Old Kent Road, making for Cromley. We couldn't go to a London Spike, for Paddy had been in one recently and didn't care to risk going again. It was a 16-mile walk of asphalt, blistering to the heels, and we were acutely hungry. Paddy browsed the pavement, laying up a store of cigarette ends against his time in the Spike. In the end, his perseverance was rewarded, for he picked up a penny. We bought a large piece of stale bread and devoured it as we walked. When we got to Cromley, it was too early to go to the Spike, and we walked several miles farther, to a plantation beside a meadow, where one could sit down. It was a regular caravansary of tramps. One could tell it by the worn grass and the sodden newspaper and the rusty cans that they had left behind. Other tramps were arriving by ones and twos. It was jolly autumn weather. Nearby, a deep bed of tansies was growing,
It seems to me that even now I can smell the sharp reek of those tansies, warring with the reek of tramps. In the meadow, two cart-horse colts, raw sienna colour with white manes and tails, were nibbling at a gate. We sprawled about on the ground, sweaty and exhausted. Someone managed to find dry sticks and get a fire going, and we all had milkless tea out of a tin drum, which was passed round. Some of the tramps began telling stories. One of them, Bill, was an interesting type, a genuine sturdy beggar of the old breed, strong as Hercules, and a frank foe of work. He boasted that with his great strength he could get a navvying job any time he liked, but as soon as he drew his first week's wages he went on a terrific drunk and was sacked. Between whiles he mooched, chiefly from shopkeepers. He talked like this.
"I ain't going far in fucking Kent. Kent's a tight county, Kent is. There's too many been mooching about here. Fucking bakers get so as they'll throw their bread away sooner and give it to you. Now Oxford, that's the place for mooching, Oxford is. When I was in Oxford, I mooched bread and I mooched bacon and I mooched beef. And every night I mooched tanners for my kip, offered to students. The last night I was tuppence short of my kip. So I goes up to a parson and mooches him for threepence. He give me threepence, and the next moment he turns round and gives me in charge for begging. 'You've been begging,' the copper says. 'No, I ain't,' I says. 'I was asking the gentleman the time,' I says. The copper starts feeling inside my coat, and he pulls out a pound of meat and two loaves of bread. 'Well, what's all this then?' he says. 'You better come look to the station,' he says. 'The beat give me 7 days. I don't mooch from no more fucking parsons, but Christ, what do I care for a lay-up of 7 days? Etc., etc. It seemed that his whole life was this, a round of mooching, drunks and lay-ups. He laughed as he talked of it, taking it all for a tremendous joke. He looked as though he made a poor thing out of begging, for he wore only a corduroy suit, scarf and cap. No socks or linen. Still, he was fat and jolly, and he even smelt of beer, the most unusual smell in a tramp nowadays. Two of the tramps had been in Cromley Spike recently, and they told a ghost story connected with it. Years earlier, they said, there had been a suicide there. A tramp had managed to smuggle a razor into his cell and there cut his throat. In the morning, when the tramp major came round, the body was jammed against the door, and to open it, they had to break the dead man's arm. In revenge for this, the dead man haunted his cell, and anyone who slept there was certain to die within the year. There were copious instances, of course. If a cell door stuck when you tried to open it, you should avoid that cell like the plague, for it was the haunted one. Two tramps, ex-sailors, told another grisly story. A man, they swore they'd known him, had planned to stow away on a boat bound for Chile. It was laden with manufactured goods packed in big wooden crates, and with the help of a docker, the stowaway had managed to hide himself in one of these. But the docker had made a mistake about the order in which the crates were to be loaded. The crane gripped the stowaway, swung him aloft, and deposited him at the very bottom of the hold, beneath hundreds of crates. No one discovered what had happened until the end of the voyage, when they found the stowaway rotting, dead of suffocation. Another tramp told the story of Gilderoy, the Scottish robber. Gilderoy was the man who was condemned to be hanged, escaped, captured the judge who had sentenced him, and, splendid fellow, hanged him. The tramps liked the story, of course, but the interesting thing was to see that they'd got it all wrong. Their version was that Gilderoy escaped to America, whereas in reality he was recaptured and put to death. The story had been amended, no doubt deliberately, just as children amend the stories of Samson and Robin Hood, giving them happy endings which are quite imaginary. This set the tramps talking about history, and a very old man declared that the one-bite law was a survival from days when the nobles hunted men instead of deer. Some of the others laughed at him, but he had the idea firm in his head. He had heard, too, of the corn laws and the jus primae noctis. He believed it had really existed. Also of the Great Rebellion, which he thought was a rebellion of poor against rich. Perhaps he'd got it mixed up with the peasant rebellions. I doubt whether the old man could read, and certainly he was not repeating newspaper articles.
His scraps of history had been passed from generation to generation of tramps, perhaps for centuries in some cases. It was oral tradition lingering on, like a faint echo from the Middle Ages. Paddy and I went to the Spike at 6 in the evening, getting out at 10 in the morning. It was much like Rompton and Edbury, and we saw nothing of the ghost. Among the casuals were two young men named William and Fred, ex-fishermen from Norfolk, a lively pair and fond of singing. They had a song called Unhappy Bella that is worth writing down. I heard them sing it 6 times during the next 2 days, and I managed to get it by heart, except a line or two, which I've guessed. It ran, Bella was young and Bella was fair, with bright blue eyes and golden hair. Oh, unhappy Bella! Her step was light and her heart was gay, but she had no sense, and one fine day she got herself put in the family way by a wicked, heartless, cruel deceiver. Poor Bella was young. She didn't believe that the world is hard and men deceive. Oh, unhappy Bella! She said, My man will do what's just. He'll marry me now because he must. Her heart was full of loving trust in a wicked, heartless, cruel deceiver. She went to his house. That dirty skunk had packed his bags and done a bunk. Oh, unhappy Bella! Her landlady said, Get out, you whore. I won't have your sort a-darkening my door. Poor Bella was put to affliction sore by a wicked, heartless, cruel deceiver. All night she tramped the cruel snows. What she must have suffered nobody knows. Oh, unhappy Bella! And when the morning dawned so red, alas, alas, poor Bella was dead, sent so young to her lonely bed by a wicked, heartless, cruel deceiver. So thus, you see, do what you will, the fruits of sin are suffering still. Oh, unhappy Bella! As into the grave they laid her low, the men said, Alas, but life is so. But the women chanted, sweet and low, It's all the men, the dirty bastards. Written by a woman, perhaps. William and Fred, the singers of this song, were thorough scallywags, the sort of men who get tramps a bad name. They happened to know that the tramp major at Cromley had a stock of old clothes, which were to be given at need to casuals. Before going in, William and Fred took off their boots, ripped the seams and cut pieces off the soles, more or less ruining them. Then they applied for 2 pairs of boots, and the tramp major, seeing how bad their boots were, gave them almost new pairs. William and Fred were scarcely outside the Spike in the morning before they had sold these boots for 1 and 9. It seemed to them quite worthwhile, for 1 and 9, to make their own boots practically unwearable. Leaving the Spike, we all started southward, a long, slouching procession, for Lower Binfield and Hyde Hill. On the way, there was a fight between 2 of the tramps. They had quarrelled overnight. There was some silly casus belli about one saying to the other, Bullshit, which was taken for Bolshevik, a deadly insult, and they fought it out in a field. A dozen of us stayed to watch them. The scene sticks in my mind for one thing. The man who was beaten, going down, and his cap falling off, and showing that his hair was quite white. After that, some of us intervened and stopped the fight. Paddy had meanwhile been making inquiries, and found that the real cause of the quarrel was, as usual, a few pennyworth of food. We got to Lower Binfield quite early, and Paddy filled in the time by asking for work at back doors. At one house he was given some boxes to chop up for firewood, and saying he had a mate outside, he brought me in, and we did the work together. When it was done, the householder told the maid to take us out a cup of tea. I remember the terrified way in which she brought it out, and then, losing her courage, set the cups down on the path and bolted back to the house, shutting herself in the kitchen. So dreadful is the name of tramp. They paid us 6 each, and we bought a 3-penny loaf and 1/2 ounce of tobacco, leaving 5. Paddy thought it wiser to bury our 5, for the tramp major at Lower Binfield was renowned as a tyrant, and might refuse to admit us if we had any money at all. It's quite a common practice of tramps to bury their money. If they intend to smuggle a tall or large sum into the Spike, they generally sew it into their clothes, which may mean prison if they're caught, of course. Paddy and Bozo used to tell a good story about this. An Irishman, Bozo said it was an Irishman, Paddy said an Englishman, not a tramp, and in possession of £30, was stranded in a small village where he could not get a bed. He consulted a tramp, who advised him to go to the workhouse. It's quite a regular proceeding if one cannot get a bed elsewhere to get one at the workhouse, paying a reasonable sum for it. The Irishman, however, thought he would be clever and get a bed for nothing, so he presented himself at the workhouse as an ordinary casual. He had sewn the £30 into his clothes. Meanwhile, the tramp who advised him had seen his chance, and that night he privately asked the tramp major for permission to leave the spike early in the morning, as he had to see about a job. At 6 in the morning he was released and went out, in the Irishman's clothes. The Irishman complained of the theft, and was given 30 days for going into a casual ward under false pretences. Chapter 35. Arrived at Lower Binfield, we sprawled for a long time on the green, watched by cottagers from their front gates. A clergyman and his daughter came and stared silently at us for a while, as though we'd been aquarium fishes, and then went away again. There were several dozen of us waiting. William and Fred were there, still singing, and the men who had fought, and Bill the moocher. He'd been mooching from bakers, and had quantities of stale bread tucked away between his coat and his bare body. He shared it out, and we were all glad of it. There was a woman among us, the first woman tramp I'd ever seen. She was a fattish, battered, very dirty woman of 60, in a long, trailing black skirt. She put on great airs of dignity, and if anyone sat down near her, she sniffed and moved farther off. "Where you bound for, missus?" one of the tramps called to her. The woman sniffed and looked into the distance. "Come on, missus," he said. "Cheer up, be chummy. We're all in the same boat here." "Thank you," said the woman bitterly. "When I want to get mixed up with a set of tramps, I'll let you know." I enjoyed the way she said, "tramps." It seemed to show you in a flash the whole of her soul. A small, blinkered, feminine soul that had learned absolutely nothing from years on the road. She was no doubt a respectable widow woman, become a tramp through some grotesque accident. The spike opened at 6. This was Saturday, and we were to be confined over the weekend, which is the usual practice. Why, I don't know, unless it's from a vague feeling that Sunday merits something disagreeable. When we registered, I gave my trade as journalist. It was truer than painter, for I had sometimes earned money from newspaper articles. But it was a silly thing to say, being bound to lead to questions. As soon as we were inside the spike, and had been lined up for the search, the tramp major called my name. He was a stiff, soldierly man of 40, not looking the bully he'd been represented, but with an old soldier's gruffness. He said sharply, "Which of you is blank?" I forget what name I'd given. "Me, sir." "So you're a journalist?" "Yes, sir," I said, quaking. A few questions would betray the fact that I'd been lying, which might mean prison. But the tramp major only looked me up and down and said, "Then you're a gentleman?" "I suppose so." He gave me another long look. "Well, that's bloody bad luck, Governor," he said. "Bloody bad luck, that is." And thereafter he treated me with unfair favouritism, and even with a kind of deference. He did not search me, and in the bathroom he actually gave me a clean towel to myself, an unheard-of luxury. So powerful is the word gentleman in an old soldier's ear. By 7, we had wolfed our bread and tea, and were in our cells. We slept one in a cell, and there were bedsteads and straw palliasses, so that one ought to have had a good night's sleep. But no spike is perfect, and the peculiar shortcoming at Lower Binfield was the cold. The hot pipes were not working, and the two blankets we had been given were thin cotton things and almost useless. It was only autumn, but the cold was bitter. One spent the long 12-hour night in turning from side to side, falling asleep for a few minutes and waking up shivering. We could not smoke, for our tobacco, which we had managed to smuggle in, was in our clothes, and we should not get these back till the morning. All down the passage one could hear groaning noises, and sometimes a shouted oath. No one, I imagine, got more than an hour or two of sleep. In the morning, after breakfast and the doctor's inspection, the tramp major herded us all into the dining room and locked the door upon us. It was a lime-washed, stone-floored room, unutterably dreary, with its furniture of deal, boards and benches, and its prison smell. The barred windows were too high to look out of, and there were no ornaments save a clock and a copy of the workhouse rules. Packed elbow to elbow on the benches, we were bored already, though it was barely 8 in the morning. There was nothing to do, nothing to talk about, not even room to move. The sole consolation was that one could smoke, for smoking was connived at so long as one was not caught in the act. Scotty, a little hairy tramp, with a bastard accent sired by Cockney out of Glasgow, was tobacco-less, his tin of cigarette ends having fallen out of his boot during the search and been impounded. I stood in the makings of a cigarette. We smoked furtively, thrusting our cigarettes into our pockets like schoolboys when we heard the tramp major coming. Most of the tramps spent 10 continuous hours in this comfortless, soulless room. Heaven knows how they put up with it. I was luckier than the others, for at 10 o'clock the tramp major told off a few men for odd jobs, and he picked me out to help in the workhouse kitchen, the most coveted job of all. This, like the clean towel, was a charm worked by the word gentleman. There was no work to do in the kitchen, and I sneaked off into a small shed used for storing potatoes, where some workhouse paupers were skulking to avoid the Sunday morning service. There were comfortable packing cases to sit on, and some back numbers of the Family Herald, and even a copy of Raffles from the workhouse library. The paupers talked interestingly about workhouse life. They told me, among other things, that the thing really hated in the workhouse, as a stigma of charity, is the uniform. If the men could wear their own clothes, or even their own caps and scarves, they wouldn't mind being paupers. I had my dinner from the workhouse table, and it was a meal fit for a boa constrictor. The largest meal I had eaten since my first day at the Hotel X. The paupers said that they habitually gorged to the bursting point on Sunday and were underfed the rest of the week. After dinner, the cook set me to do the washing up and told me to throw away the food that remained. The wastage was astonishing, and in the circumstances appalling. Half-eaten joints of meat and bucketfuls of broken bread and vegetables were pitched away like so much rubbish and then defiled with tea leaves. I filled 5 dustbins to overflowing with quite eatable food, and while I did so, 50 tramps were sitting in the spike, with their bellies half filled by the spike dinner of bread and cheese, and perhaps 2 cold boiled potatoes each in honour of Sunday. According to the paupers, the food was thrown away from deliberate policy, rather than it should be given to the tramps. At 3, I went back to the spike. The tramps had been sitting there since 8, with hardly room to move an elbow, and they were now half mad with boredom. Even smoking was at an end, for a tramp's tobacco has picked up cigarette ends, and he starves if he's more than a few hours away from the pavement. Most of the men were too bored even to talk. They just sat packed on the benches, staring at nothing, their scrubby faces split in two by enormous yawns. The room stank of ennui. Paddy, his backside aching from the hard bench, was in a whimpering mood, and to pass the time away I talked with a rather superior tramp, a young carpenter who wore a collar and tie, and was on the road, he said, for lack of a set of tools. He kept a little aloof from the other tramps, and held himself more like a free man than a casual. He had literary tastes, too, and carried a copy of Quentin Durward in his pocket. He told me that he never went into a spike unless driven there by hunger.